This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Not everyone realizes scientists are cool. I'm glad all of you do. Scientists are cool. That does remind me. So when my daughter was like, As was described in the introduction, my background is really as a basic scientist. I studied the physics of how proteins behave for a long time. And, you know, amongst the 500 or 1,000 people in the world who care about that, I was really famous. I'm completely full of myself. And then one day, about a decade ago, my daughter was probably like 5 years old at the time, and she was trying to remember the name of a friend of mine who's a medical doctor. And to jog my memory, she said, "He's a doctor, but he's not the kind you are. He's the kind that helps people." And so now I'm an engineer. And now my goal is to help people, or the goal of my research lab. To illustrate the overarching goal of my lab, imagine, think forward a few years. You're in college. Actually, sorry, none of you. This story doesn't apply to any of you. Some friend of yours. You're in college. Some friend of yours, goes to a party, has too much to drink, does something stupid, has unprotected sex, wakes up the next morning. He or she is worried, oh my God, did I just expose myself to HIV? What do? You go to your doctor's office, right? And you get an HIV test. What's that entail? Well, your doctor draws blood. Actually, that's not true, is it? Any of you ever had your doctor draw blood? They don't draw blood. In fact, in my clinic, even the nurses don't draw blood. My doctor wants me to have a blood test. He sends me several blocks down the road to the local laboratory, they call it. And I put that in air quotes because while they draw blood at the laboratory, they don't actually do any tests in the laboratory. They then send the blood across town. From my local blood draw clinic, they send a courier about every 20 minutes across town to a big central clearinghouse laboratory. Just completely stole this off the internet without attributing it to anybody. Don't do that. Picture of one of those central clearinghouse clinical laboratories where they'll take that blood sample and they'll run it through one of these instruments. This is an automated, effectively this is a robot that performs a multi-step analytical process to look for antibodies that your friend's body may have generated against the HIV virus. We've got great and very sensitive ways of detecting those antibodies, and if your body has generated antibodies, that means you've got the virus. So detecting antibodies is akin to detecting the virus. We've got great, incredibly sensitive ways of detecting those antibodies, but our processes for doing that are that. They're processes. They're multi-step processes. It requires that we add this chemical, and we add that chemical, and we wash, and we incubate, and we wash some more. It's kind of slow and cumbersome. It takes about an hour, and there's a bunch of reagent additions. But here in the developed world, that's fine. We just build a $250,000 robot that does it, and we hire someone with a college degree to run that robot. And then after an hour, the answer pops out, and she pulls the paper off, goes over to the email, and emails the answer back to the doctor. The doctor calls you up, and she says, "You got lucky this time." So it's a complicated process. Not a big deal, though, right? Not a big deal here in California, where $250,000 instrument, that's a lot of money, but our doctors get paid a lot. It's not that much money in comparison. A lot of people with bachelor's degrees looking for jobs running robots, couriers, email, all of those things are trivial. The reagents, those chemicals that go into the instrument, they cost like about $5 a test. Again, not a big deal here. None of those steps is a big deal here in Santa Barbara, and every one of those steps would be a big deal here. This is a little village at the end of a 50-kilometer-long dirt road. Do you kids know the metric system? Silence. Sometimes it's like us in Liberia still. Actually, no, I think Liberia uses the metric system already. Just us. 50 kilometers, 30-mile-long dirt road in Malawi, right? This is a little village. They don't have couriers going to that central clearinghouse laboratory. They don't even have people drawing blood. They certainly don't have many people with bachelor's degrees to run the instruments, and they can't afford $5 for an assay because healthcare expenditure per person per year in this country, it's in Southern Africa, by the way, is of order $20. So we want to develop, the overarching goal of my research group is develop molecular diagnostics, to develop methods of measuring specific medically interesting, medically relevant molecules that are so cheap and so convenient that they'd impact healthcare someplace like this. Now to do that, we're going to have to reduce the cost by a factor of 100. We're going to have to increase the efficiency and ease of the assay by a factor of 1,000. Not a factor of 2, factors of 100, factors of 1,000. Not so easy to do. But that's what us academics do, right? In industry, people looking at short-term research projects where they want to tweak something, want to make a widget that works 15% better than the other guy's widget so you can corner the market. As an academic, my job is to, I got tenure, I can't be fired, right? So if I fail, it's completely okay. It's a great job, by the way. As an academic, therefore, you know, society's entrusted that into me. Society said, okay, look, we're gonna protect you. You can't be fired, you can do whatever the hell you want, so do something risky, crazy, high risk, high return. This is what we wanna do. We wanna make new technologies, revolutionary technologies that completely circumvent existing technologies and are so much better than existing technologies that they'd work someplace like this. Now, of course, if we had a technology that worked someplace like this, it would also work in your doctor's office, and you could get the test results immediately. And that's actually of significance even here. Back to that HIV test example. If you look at typical inner-city sexually transmitted disease clinics in, say, New York City, the fraction of people who call back the next day to get the answer is very small. It's alarmingly small. People take the they get worried, they take the test, and then it's such a bother to call the next day to find out what the answer is. Whereas if instead the clinician could tell the patient immediately, yes, you have this disease, you need to start changing your behavior, you need to start taking this treatment, it would significantly improve the efficacy with which we could treat those diseases. So make a technology that will help here, very hard to do, but if we achieve it, it'll also help us even here in the developed world, where to a certain extent the problem seems solved at first glance. Okay, so how are we going to do this? Well, I'm a biologist by training, and so I think biology is going to solve the problem. And specifically, the type of technology we're developing is called, the class of devices we're building are called biosensors. And by that I mean an analytical device, a device that detects and measures a specific molecule that's based on biological recognition, based on some piece of biology recognizing a molecule. Now, we humans have been doing that for a long time. You know, build canary in a coal mine when miners take canaries down in the mines to detect toxic gases. That's biorecognition, right? The living thing detects the toxic gases, dies, gives you a signal. But it's even broader than that. The ancient Greeks diagnosed diabetes as that disease that causes insects to come to your urine. Because diabetics have such high blood sugar levels, they piss out a lot of sugar, and so the insects like their urine. And indeed, in fact, that robot that I told you about that's detecting anti-HIV antibodies, that's based on biological recognition. Some of the reagents that go into that are specific proteins that detect that specific antibody. So we already use biological recognition as the basis of most of our clinical diagnostics. But like I said, that robot, the reason we use a robot is because that's a multi-step process. That makes it slow and cumbersome and costly. I want to circumvent that. I want a device. I don't want a process. Even if you can automate the process with a robot, I don't want a process. I want a device. I want a device where you put in a sample and you press a button and something goes bing and then you get the answer, right? Single step, quantitative. Got a biological recognition element, some protein, some DNA molecule that recognizes your target. When it recognizes it, some specific quantitative output occurs. Now, this idea is not novel with me. In part, in fact, we scientists have been exploring this idea for about 50 years now. Again, based on the fact that biological recognition is so amazing. How is it amazing? Well, biological recognition is very generalizable. We can make a protein or a DNA molecule that'll recognize almost any water-soluble molecule we might be interested in. I mean, actually, literally, you can. You can make, let me pick someone at random, you could make antibodies, these proteins in your blood, you can make an antibody that will bind some virus that no human's ever seen before in the history of our species. Our immune systems can make biomolecules that act as reagents that recognize specific new molecular targets that no one's ever seen before. So biological recognition is very generalizable. We can make biomolecules that'll recognize anything. they generally recognize their targets very avidly. They bind their targets very, very tightly. Typically, an antibody will bind its target antigen at concentrations of down to picomolar. If you've had chemistry, that might mean something. If you haven't, just take my word for it. That's insanely low. And then we can also make a DNA molecule. If you want to detect a DNA molecule, say you want to detect the nucleic acids in the HIV virion, you could detect them by designing a DNA molecule that would hybridize to it, that would bind to it using that simple ATGC base pairing pattern. And those interactions are even tighter. So you can detect one DNA molecule using another DNA molecule at concentrations down those Greek prefixes that they didn't teach me when I was in high school, like attomolar, like 10 to the minus 18th of a molar, really crazy low concentrations. So biological recognition, very general, very, very tight binding, and so we should be able to get very sensitive low-level detection. And then finally, biological recognition is generally very, very specific, which is why if you catch the flu this year, you're not immune to next year's flu strain. Because you catch the flu this year, your body makes antibodies that bind to the flu virus and kill it. But the virus only has to evolve a little tiny bit and only change just a tiny fraction of its outer coat to avoid last year's antibodies next year, because biology is so specific. So if we could make a generic platform, some generic technology that just detected whenever a biomolecule binds its target and goes, you know, bing, and then gives us a number, in theory, it could be an amazingly sensitive and specific and general means of detecting specific molecules. And again, this idea has been around for a long time. It wasn't original to me. We scientists and engineers have been spent much of the last 50 years trying to develop technologies based on that, and haven't had much luck. So there was about a decade ago, there was this new trend, where all the cool professors would like put pictures of their graduate students in their talks. And so my students told me this, and I told them, okay, fine, I'll put your pictures in the talk if you can figure out how I can integrate you organically. It's like, you know, scale bars or something. And so here's Jonathan Cohen, who's 2 meters tall, just under 2 meters tall, is a scale bar showing you. This is 1 year of a scientific journal dedicated entirely to biosensors. We scientists publish a lot of papers about biosensors. Huge number of papers, and yet, and we've been doing it for 50 years. And yet, in terms of these single-step devices, there's only one success story out there. 50 years of academic research, one success. Like I said, it is a great job, by the way. That one success is the glucose sensor that diabetics use, which you can go down to the local pharmacy and buy for $20. Takes about 30 seconds to generate a signal. Completely untrained people use it. You know, my grandma had one. She stored it in her underwear drawer. Just, you know, it's amazing technology. By the way, so I'm a university professor. I don't usually talk to high school students. As a university professor, I can say whatever the hell I want. I can cuss. I can talk about sex, drugs. By the way, disclaimer, this talk does acknowledge both the existence of sex and drugs. And my grandmother's underwear drawer. Anyway, where was I? So 50 years of academic literature and one device. What's the problem? Well, the problem is most biomolecules, when they bind their targets, they don't do anything. So those antibodies I keep talking about, when an antibody binds its target molecule, say a target virus, nothing happens to the antibody. It doesn't change shape. It doesn't emit light. It doesn't emit electrons. So how do we build a technology that can tell when the antibody is bound to its target if the antibody doesn't do anything? Not so easy. Well, I guess actually there is an easy answer to it. And engineers have been pursuing this easy answer for 50 years. And that answer is, we tie the antibody or other biomolecule, we tie it down to a surface. And then when the target molecule binds, that changes the surface in a variety of ways. I mean, the target molecule has some mass. So when the target molecule binds, the mass loaded on the surface will increase. And engineers have come up with wonderfully sensitive ways of measuring mass. We can make biosensors that way. Similarly, if the target is charged, and most molecules are charged in solution, then when the target molecule binds the surface, that changes the electric field at the surface. And mechanical engineers have made wonderful ways of measuring mass. Electrical engineers have made wonderful ways of measuring electric fields. We can make biosensors that way. When the target binds, it displaces water at the surface. And the target's optical properties are different than the optical properties of water. And so that changes the optical properties at this interface. And optical engineers are really smart and have come up with wonderfully sensitive ways of detecting when things bind to a surface that way. And all of these technologies work to some extent. Research groups build them, show that they work, graduate students publish papers, they get their PhDs, they leave over and over again. And not one of these technologies, over and over again for 30 years plus, and not one of these technologies is in that central clearinghouse laboratory we have here in town, much less in your doctor's office. The problem is, they don't work in the real world. They work reasonably well in an academic laboratory, where we're trying to detect some really pure protein. We take absolutely pure target molecule, and we detect how much of that's there. That's no problem. But that's not the scenario in the real world. In the real world, your medical doctor wants to detect some specific protein, some specific antibody, in blood serum. You know how many proteins are in blood serum? Thousands. So we're trying to detect one protein against thousands and thousands of other proteins, not just one protein. It's one thing to just measure a protein. It's quite another to measure a protein against a background of thousands of others. And in that second scenario, these technologies all fail. The problem is all of these technologies are just measuring when things adsorb to a surface by measuring the change in adsorbed mass or charge, et cetera. And when we run a sensor like that in a realistic sample, nonspecific adsorption occurs. You got 5,000 different proteins in blood serum. Some of them are going to stick to your surface no matter what you coat your surface with. And when they stick, well, they change the mass and the electric field too. So none of these adsorption-based approaches that have been pursued for decades works in the real world because this nonspecific adsorption generates a signal that's identical to the authentic signal and ruins them. All right, so how are we going to solve this problem? Well, my background's not engineering. My background's in biology. My PhD is in biology. And so I look to biology for inspiration. Because biology has solved this problem, right? Your bodies are detecting all kinds of molecules all the time. In fact, more broadly, biology's great at detecting molecules. I didn't get an awe out of this. It's like, come on, awe. It's my dog, Zev. I'm sorry, that's my golden retriever, Zev. They like dogs, but they're better. I just wanted to work this in. Actually, it is relevant, though, right? I mean, dogs' noses are amazing. Dogs can detect. No one has ever found two different molecules that dogs can't discriminate between. The dog's ability to smell is even better than our ability to distinguish colors. It's insanely good. So there's an example of a highly sensitive, extremely general biosensor right there that doesn't require wash steps and reagent additions. It just plain works. We want to reiterate that. How are we going to do it? Well, how does biology do it? I mean, it's one thing to just say, oh, biology solved the problem, but that doesn't tell us how to translate biology's solution into artificial technology. We need to delve a little deeper. So how does biology solve the problem? Well, in her nose are a bunch of receptors, biomolecules, proteins in this case, that detect specific molecules. Cartoon diagram of one of them. When these receptors bind their target, the receptor changes shape a little bit. The gray is the shape that you see when there's no target there, and the blue is the shape you see when there is a target there. It's not a very big conformational change, but the point is the receptor changes shape when it binds its target, and it's that shape change that generates a signal. So biologically relevant chemoperception, the detection of molecules by biological systems, is not driven by these generic properties like changes in mass, changes in charge. Instead, it's driven by highly specific changes in the shape of the receptor that occur when the receptor finds its target. Again, coming at this field from the direction of biology, not engineering, we set out to explore that idea. How can we re-engineer receptors so that they undergo very large shape changes when they bind their target? And then how can we take that shape change and translate it into an output that we can easily detect in something as complex as blood serum? Reiterating again. So what we want to do is couple the recognition event with a change in the shape of the receptor so that that generates a signal, not just absorption. And in those case, in those circumstances, nonspecific absorption won't lead to a signal and won't cause us any problems. How are we going to do it? Well, here's an early example from my lab. We built a sensor for detecting specific DNA sequences. The probe, the biomolecule in the sensor, is a single strand of DNA that has self-complementary ends. So the A's and T's and G's and C's here match up with those here, and it forms a little double. It's a single molecule, not two strands, but the two ends come together and form a double helix connected by a long, floppy, single-stranded loop. We tie one end of that down to an electrode, chemically connected to a gold electrode. On the other end of the DNA molecule, we add a molecule called methylene blue. Methylene blue is a molecule that is very happy to take on an extra electron or give up an electron. In the absence of the target, this DNA molecule forms a stem loop. That methylene blue is pushed right up against the electrode. If we apply a voltage to this electrode, that'll cause electrons to flow to the methylene blue. That gives us a current, which we can easily measure. In the presence of a DNA target that is complementary to this loop, it binds to the loop. Double-stranded DNA is much, much more rigid than single-stranded DNA. That breaks the stem, causes the DNA molecule to stand up, pulls that methylene blue away from the surface, and turns off that electron transfer and turns off that current. So we're going to sweep a voltage in this electrode. We're going to measure the current. If there's a lot of current, we're in this configuration. If there's not much current, we're in this configuration, indicating, therefore, that the target is there. This works pretty well. So here we're sweeping the voltage, and we're measuring the current. And we see in the absence of any target, there's lots of current. In the presence of a very high concentration of target, all of that DNA is now double-stranded, is hybridized to the target, is double-stranded, is standing up. Down nanomolar target, down to a picomolar target. Now again, picomolar, so 10 to the minus 12th of a molar, maybe not the most meaningful units. I'll show you a picture. Oops. Apologies. I'll go back to the picture. So we're getting, for now, take my word, this is nice sensitive detection. Remember, what is it that I wanted? I wanted a single-step device, not a process. We have that here because everything necessary to generate the signal is put there during the manufacturing. The user just puts in the target and presses go. Now, that said, if you're willing to add one step, we could wash the target away, and because everything is strongly attached to the electrode, we can just reuse the sensor again. And they're nicely reusable. So here we challenge with DNA, wash, challenge, wash, challenge, wash, challenge, until the student gets bored. They always get bored around here. Nicely reusable. Some other advantages. We can make these really small. So here are our electrodes. That's 100. That little gold square there is an electrode. It's 100 microns on a side. So that's at 1/10 of 1 millimeter. So this is an array of 8 sensors. These are the wires, the leads that connect them out to the real world. We printed this on glass, and I put the glass on a penny for scale. So there's the president's chin. It's really small. And even these really small devices give an excellent signal to noise. The electronics to drive these are very cheap. Actually, that's not quite true. To make these current voltage sweeps in the laboratory, we use a device called a potentiostat. And the cheapest laboratory potentiostats cost about $1,500, $2,000. And five years ago, one of my students said, "This is crazy. It's 21st century. Electronics are dirt cheap. It shouldn't cost $2,000 for one of these." And so one of my graduate students we have a senior level undergraduate capstone electrical engineer design course where the undergraduates get together in a lab, teams of 4 or 5 of them, pick some challenge and come up with a solution to it. And so my graduate student challenged these 5 undergraduates to come up with a cheap design for one of these potentiostats we call the cheap stat. And we published this about 4 or 5 years ago. We have them built for us for about $90 in lots of about 12. So if you're making 10,000 of them, they cost about $10. The electronics is very cheap. But the big question, right? Remember, what was my whole point? My whole point was that if we couple recognition to a big change in physics, then we're going to, our sensor should be nice and selective, shouldn't care about nonspecific binding, and that's true. So here's the sensor in just buffer. Here's the sensor in 50% blood serum, and then blood serum dope with nanomolar concentrations of DNA, nice and sensitive, and still reusable. Still reusable. Challenge them with all kinds of things, you know, blood, serum, urine, saliva. This is 50% dirt in buffer. You tell college students to go try some type of food, this is what they pick. No signal in the absence of target, nice signal in the presence of target. And right, just wasn't just any beer. We have class. This is Yi Zha, who did this work. She's now a professor at Florida International University in Miami. And then here's Chun Hai Fan, who invented this technology. He's a professor at Shanghai Institute of Applied Physics now. So this is that detection limit. Our detection limit was a few tens of picomolar. Not 10 picomolar, but a few tens of picomolar. That would be 150 milligrams of DNA in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Pretty good. Not good enough, though. We need to be better if we want to detect viral loads directly. How do we make this better? Oh, come on. Well, the sensor has a problem. It's a signal-off sensor. The target suppresses the current. There's a problem with that. You can only suppress 100% of the current. It'd be better if the target turned things on, because if the target increases the signal can go up 200%, 8,000%, whatever. Right? Down, you can only go down 100%. Up, you can go up as high as you want. So we can make a better sensor if we make it signal on. Here, we've done that. Here, we started with mostly double-stranded probe that keeps that methylene blue away from the surface. The target displaces the green strand. Now it's flexible, can touch the surface. So low current, high current. And now, whereas before we had, we had 50% suppression at 50 nanomolar, now we have 700% signal increase. And now our detection limit's down in the femtomolar regime. That's 10 to the minus 15th molar. Now we're getting somewhere, milligrams in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. That's DNA detection. We can detect lots of other things with this. We can detect, for instance, proteins that bind DNA. A lot of proteins that bind DNA, proteins that regulate transcription, proteins that regulate gene function, like the proteins that turn cancer on. So we want to be able to detect proteins that bind DNA. So we just put in the DNA that the protein binds to. When the protein binds to it, that reduces the ease with which this can collide with the surface just because it's big and bulky. And we get a nice signal. There's just a couple of them. We've made many of them. We can expand it further still. There are ways in the laboratory that we can make DNA molecules that behave like antibodies do. We can make DNA molecules that will bind some new targets, new proteins, new small molecules. These are called aptamers. We can slot those into our sensor. We destabilize the aptamer so that it's a little bit unfolded. When it binds the target, it folds. It changes the ability of that methylene blue to hit the surface. Oops. So, no target with target. Same sensor used twice, buffer blood serum. Doesn't care. The detection limit here is nice and low, 50 picomolar. This is below clinically relevant. We can easily detect clinically relevant concentrations. Those other adsorption-based technologies that I was dissing before have that ability too, but what they can't do is do it so selectively. Okay, there we go. So we're detecting parts per billion of our target, but the more important thing is, the equally important thing is that we're detecting those parts per billion in blood serum. So we're detecting our target against a 30 million-fold excess of wrong things. That's for proteins. We can also detect small molecules. So we took one of these DNA molecules that folds up in the presence of this molecule. It's cocaine. I assume none of you knew that. The binding interface, this is a small molecule, so it doesn't bind as much of the DNA, and so it doesn't bind as tightly, but we can still detect down to a few micromolar cocaine, just at clinically relevant levels in blood serum. And since I know you were curious, there we go. About a kilogram. I was setting this joke up the whole time. Here's my collaborators. Rebecca's a professor at University of Nebraska. Brian's a staff scientist up at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which is a very uptight place, so I promised I would never show this picture there. This is my collaborator, Alan Heger. Professor Heger is a professor in physics here, Nobel Prize winner. I love the fact that when you get the Nobel Prize, they give you the ice. No, I'm not kidding. They give you a lapel pin. This is his Nobel Prize lapel pin. All right. By the way, this has got a lot of press. Research is the notorious party school, UCSB, build a sensor for detecting cocaine. We were on the Fox National News. Wow. And at one point on the Fox National News, they said we did this experiment, which we didn't, right? It would cost $100,000 to do this experiment. You're right. So we can detect lots of things with these molecules. We expanded a little further more recently. Now we're using it to detect antibodies. We stick the thing that the antibody binds onto DNA. That reduces the efficiency with the methylene blue gets to the surface. Here we've taken HIV-positive blood serum and diluted it up to 1,000-fold in negative blood serum, and we're still getting decent signal. So we can detect these anti-HIV antibodies in blood serum at concentrations 1,000-fold lower than those that are seen in patients. So now we've got a really clinically viable device. And this little device that's you can hold in your palm, and we can measure maybe a dozen different antibodies in a single finger prick volume, so no blood draws. It takes 10 minutes. We have a technology that may actually work at the point of care. It may actually work in that little village in Malawi. Last few slides. Because the device is reagentless and doesn't require wash steps, we can use it for continuous monitoring. So I know I'll go over the last couple of slides quickly because I know Professor So spoke here a few weeks ago. So collaborating with Professor So in mechanical engineering, we've integrated these into devices where we can do continuous real-time monitoring of fluctuating, in red, fluctuating cocaine concentrations here in flowing blood serum, and then with Professor So in flowing whole blood, and the next slide's a little gruesome. I think he showed you this. So here we've taken an anesthetized, hey, look, the rat's anesthetized and it's getting cocaine. Don't feel that sorry for it. Actually, that's not true here. This rat's getting doxorubicin, the cancer chemotherapeutic. So we pull blood out of the rat at a fifth of a milliliter an hour. Even for a rat, that's not blood. One-fifth of 1 milliliter per hour. Pull the blood out into our device and can measure drugs continuously in real time as the rat metabolizes. We inject it, the rat metabolizes and excretes. Inject, the rabbit metabolizes and excretes. So we can measure the pharmacokinetics. We can measure how fast a drug turns over in a specific patient. That's important. And how do we dose drugs now? It's really primitive. If you're over 12, take 2 of these pills. If you're under 12, take 1, right? Really primitive. Some drugs are too toxic for that to work, and we have to do more sophisticated things to estimate how fast your body specifically is going to metabolize the drug. But all of our means of doing that estimation are indirect and inaccurate. Here we're actually measuring it for a specific, in this case, rat, but we can do it for specific people too. All right, now here's a second drug. And I will close with that, as I said. So my understanding is most of you are not from Santa Barbara. My condolences. It's pretty nice here. These are my students who have actually done the work. One of the nice things about being an academic in general and being a professor particularly at Santa Barbara, this is a very collaborative place. So it's a great place to do this kind of work that requires a lot more knowledge than I have. We couldn't build these devices without knowledge of biomolecular physics, which is where my expertise comes in, electrochemistry, which is how Professor Heger got involved, mechanical engineering to build devices, which is how Professor So got involved, and then finally, to do the rat studies, we need someone who knows how to do surgeries on rats and who knows something about pharmacokinetics, and that's Professor Kippen, who I believe also spoke in this session. So great place to do this sort of interdisciplinary work. And this is a great topic to train students on. So my students have done well and gone out and done well and made me proud. Chen Hai is a professor in Shanghai. Yi Zhao is a professor in Florida. Erica works here in campus and outreach. Some of you may know her. Staff scientist at the National Laboratory up in the Bay Area, professor at Colorado School of Mines, professor at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, mother of 2 really lovely children. I'm not doing a scientist now, and a current graduate student. All right, with that, thank you, everyone. Great.
In your talk, you mentioned the idea of selectivity. So basically, you were saying there's so many things going in your blood that it's really, really hard to identify one specific protein. I was just wondering how your biosensors can do that, because I assume with that many things flowing in your blood, a lot of them are similar and a lot of them have similar features.
Well, you bring up an interesting point, a nomenclature question. So I use the word selectivity there very specifically. When you think about specificity, there's sort of 2 aspects to it. One is, can my device discriminate between its proper target, and some other very closely related molecule. And we use the word specificity to discriminate that, to describe that. The biomolecules are really good at doing that. The biomolecules are good enough to do that at a clinical level of precision. So that's a solved problem on the biology side. But there's another aspect to specificity, if you will. That's it, and that's, can my device detect that specific target molecule against a 30 million-fold excess of stuff that's completely wrong? They're really different problems, right? Although we use the word specificity when you think about it to describe both of those problems. So my groups had to sort of force the field to use these two words differently, specificity and selectivity. So we use selectivity to mean, does it work when you spit in it? Does it work in dirt? And that's not given to us by the biomolecules. That's given to us by this mechanism we use in which the binding-induced shape change only signals when the proper thing binds and not when wrong things bind somewhere else. So we've got to solve both problems, and they're solved different ways. One solved by the specificity of the biomolecule, the other solved by the specificity of the mechanism that transduces that binding event to an output. But we had to think about them both, and it worked. So our specificity and selectivity are good enough. Now, you could probably artificially find molecules that were so close that our systems would fail, but they're not clinically relevant. Our specificity is good enough.
Okay, thank you.
Please.
Hi, so regarding genetics, could you like make a primer that could detect a mutation in like your genome to detect like would you use that for this?
I like that question because it segues into an important point that I didn't a philosophical point that motivates much of our research. The answer is yes. But it brings to mind a question of where do we add the most value? It's always better. If you can do things faster and cheaper, that's always better. Like, always. But sometimes it adds more value than others. So, for example, cancers evolve over the course of days and months and weeks. Days and weeks and months and years. They don't move over the course of hours. And so if you have a cancer test that takes 24 hours to return an answer, that's not a big deal. If someone thinks they've got cancer, they're going to call back to get the answer the next day. And the treatment's going to be taking days and weeks and months. And so a 24-hour delay is not a big deal. For HIV testing for sexually transmitted diseases, as I said, people don't call back the next day. So if you've got an assay that takes 10 minutes and you can tell them immediately, that adds a lot of medical value. If you're trying to optimize the dosing of some antibiotic for someone who's got a raging infection, you want to be able to do that right there because infections evolve over the course of hours. So there are many applications for which doing things much more quickly than we can currently adds a lot of value. Genetic testing's in the other camp. Right? You've got a genetic mutation. You have it for your whole life. There generally aren't many treatments. What treatments there are palliative and will be going on lifelong. And the people who think they have a genetic mutation, they're going to deleterious mutation, are going to be motivated to call back the next day. So we can use it for that, but it's not some place where we add much value over what we already have. So we're focusing on other areas.
Are you saying that it's just like more, in that sense, like you could just run a gel like and do...
Yes, that's right. The current techniques, which are just running gels, really are good enough.
Okay.
Our technique might be a tiny bit better, but just a tiny bit. It doesn't add much value. And
thanks.
So we're not pursuing it. So we're focusing instead on those things where we add enormous value.
Great. Okay. Thanks.
Oh, that guy again.
again.
Does he do this every time?
Yeah. Hi again. So I guess this was a little bit more of a question, not so much on the science side, but in terms of you trying to commercialize this. Like, you mentioned some of the real big benefits of being able to collaborate with experts here at UCSB, but are there any challenges kind of in this academia environment of trying to develop a product that you're hoping on making commercially viable?
There are challenges because the goals of my graduate students and the goals of a commercial entity trying to commercialize a technology are not congruent. They're not the same. My graduate students, their goal is to publish papers that establish them as capable, competent, efficient scientists and to have a story that they can tell to sell themselves and to sell their abilities. And a company doesn't care about the story, right? The company cares about making things better and cheaper and in often ways that don't make for good stories. I guess this goes back to one of the first things I said. As an academic, I'm looking long range. I want a revolutionary technology that's 100 times better than what exists now, not 2 times better than what exists now. So there is a discrepancy. So we really do need to get these out there into the real world. We really do need commercial partners who will do all of what we as academics think of as the drudge work to actually make them work, as opposed to the sexy work that says, hey, look, it worked once. I published a paper. No, it's different to make it work 99.99% of the time, right? So we do have, but fortunately, our technology is of interest enough. It has enough promise that fortunately there are a number of companies that have licenses to our patents and who are trying to commercialize them right now and who do that. What to me seems less glamorous, but actually is equally important work.
And so just to make sure, kind of, I guess, the quote-unquote business model you have is you license out patents for people to hopefully develop these.
That's right. There are a number of companies that have licenses to our patents and are trying to commercialize some of this now. That's right.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hi. I was wondering how, I guess, user-friendly you're expecting these devices to be. So, for example, in rural places of Africa, if they would be distributable to everyone or if they would still have to be used in a doctor's office or clinic, which I don't know how accessible that would be in these really rural areas.
You bring up a good broader point, which is if our goal is to improve healthcare in some place as undeveloped as sub-Saharan Africa, for example, there are just so many ways you can fail. Because the level of education is nil, and the batteries in a device are worth something to someone. Batteries get stolen. I mean, there are huge challenges. We may not ever get there, but if we do get there, our vision is a form factor is something like the glucose sensor, as easy to use as the glucose sensor, as cheap, as small, as portable as the glucose sensor, and not for everyone to have, but for little mobile clinics on the back of a bicycle. Right now, they don't have any analytical devices. There are, you know, in Malawi, there are people who bicycle around. There are nurses that bicycle around into the villages and do some fairly basic healthcare. But their toolkit is very limited. We want to improve their toolkit with things that are as easy and convenient as the glucose meter, but they can detect other things.
So let's thank Dr. Kevin Plaxco for the wonderful talk.
Thank you, everyone.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.